When we talk about the all-powerful bank lobby, how do we account for this setback?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning to you. I'm Bob Moon, in for Steve Chiotakis. Before we get to those questions about the banking lobby, a breaking story on jobs. Weekly unemployment claims are only slightly up from the previous week, up by about 1,000, but that still means they're stuck at a higher-than-comfortable level. Now, we told you yesterday about the fight over those fees merchants have to pay every time we consumers swipe our debit cards. Banks were fighting hard to hold off a cap on those fees, but the Senate has now decided the Federal Reserve can go ahead and impose such a fee limit. Does this signal trouble ahead for the banks in their fight over other parts of the new financial crackdown? Let's ask Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you usually cover consumer issues, but it seems to me this is one of the biggest consumer angles, and that is, how powerful does this tell us the bank lobby really is?
Well, the banks were going up against a pretty powerful foe in the form of the merchants. Merchants had spent a lot of money lobbying for this change because it works to reduce their costs.
So where does this leave us? What's next? I know that the Federal Reserve will now be deciding this cap. Where is it going to go, do you think?
All signs seem to point toward this taking effect in July as scheduled. Look, the consumer is going to get stuck with the bill on this. We're already seeing that when you see things like decline in the availability of free checking, the debit rewards programs being scaled back or being eliminated altogether. So this could easily be a $200 or $250 swing for some households.
Hold on, though. The merchants were selling this to us as this being a hidden tax and it's going to save us money?
Well, we'll see. Let me ask this. I mean, would merchants have spent millions of dollars lobbying for the change if they intended to pass along every nickel in savings to the consumer? No way. You know, let's put it this way. There weren't a whole lot of merchants that were offering lower prices for cash transactions before this. So, you know, the idea that they're going to suddenly be able to lower prices across the board because of this, the jury's still out.
Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't bother stopping me if this sounds familiar. Hackers have breached online security at insert big corporation here. This time, the names, account numbers, and email addresses of hundreds of thousands of Citibank credit card customers were compromised in early May. So why are we just hearing about this now and only after a newspaper started asking questions? We put that question to Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Citigroup isn't the only company to delay notifying its customers of a security breach. When hackers stole personal data from millions of Sony PlayStation accounts, Sony waited 5 days to tell account holders. That set off a torrent of online outrage. But there are reasons companies don't rush to sound the alarm. Rick Ferguson is director of security research at Trend Micro. He says it takes time to figure out exactly which information was stolen and who was affected.
It's more helpful to minimize the disruption to your affected customers and to eliminate any concern or disruption of your unaffected customers. And you can only really do that as a result of a thorough investigation. And unfortunately, that does take time.
If you're a Citi customer, the bank says it's in the process of contacting those affected. One reassuring note, no social security numbers, card expiration dates, or those three-digit security codes on the back of the card were stolen. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Time to check the numbers. Oil prices are up a buck a barrel, and that's weighing on markets around the world. Stocks in London and Paris virtually flat this hour. Frankfurt shares have nudged 0.1% higher.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at Manta.com. And by Indiana University's Kelly School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu.
Heads up, horse racing fans. A field of 12 3-year-olds has just been entered for this Saturday's Belmont Stakes. The 2-for-1 favorite, a horse named Animal Kingdom. Wherever in the animal kingdom do these names come from, anyway? That's what Chris Kaltenbach wondered. He's a writer for the Baltimore Sun, and he's been looking into how these famous horses get their names. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Bob.
There's actually an official process for naming thoroughbreds?
There is. All proposed names have to go through the Jockey Club. About 70% of all names that are submitted are approved, but that leaves about 30% that aren't. You can't have more than 18 letters in a name. You can't name a horse after a racetrack. So, you know, regrettably, you won't have a horse named I Love Pimlico anytime soon. You can't name a horse after a horse that's still alive. You can't name a horse after anybody who has won one of the Triple Crown races. So there are rules. And you have to be tasteful, which is the one, I guess, that people tend to run afoul of sometimes.
Now, is there anything to suggest that how they pick names has any effect on how bettors pick horses?
I don't know if there's been any studies, but you know that anybody who bets the horses is always looking for something, some hint, some lucky charm or whatever. So I suspect that there are people who look at names, and you always hear the legends of, you know, somebody who wins $1 million because they saw a horse named after their grandfather and decided to bet the house on it.
Some of these are not so great when you're a track announcer. For example, Yakahika Mikadola.
That's a name that will go down in history primarily because poor Tom Durkin, when he was calling a race, just could not wrap his mouth around that name. Each time he tried to pronounce it, it became worse. And so by the end of the race, he was just Yakamaka, Lika, Maka, Luka. Yeah, he just didn't even try anymore. So pretty hilarious.
Any rules about this? Is there a future for corporate sponsorship of horse names, maybe like race cars?
I don't know if we have a horse named Valvoline anytime soon. I'm not sure what the Jockey Club's position is on that, but I think they would look down their nose at it.
But Yakahika Mikadola is just fine with them.
Yakahika Mikadola and Flat Fleet Feet.
Easy for you to say. Chris Kaltenbach is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. He's been looking into how all these horses get their names. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
By the way, we've pulled up the YouTube video to hear how that notorious racing call for Yakahika Mikadola really sounded. Here's a sample.
And Hika Maka Rakadakalola, and
Home Room Jester,
and the trailer is Dola Rola Rola Rakadaka Mola Hola.
Couldn't have said it better myself. We've got a link to that clip on our website if you want to hear it again. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
In China, one school is trying to revolutionize its curriculum by introducing indie rock.
They just start the rock band. To be perfectly honest with you, I've heard them. They're not very good, but it's something that they love doing.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Out goes memorization, in comes fun. That's next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.